Welcome to The Brainstorm, a podcast and video series from ARK Invest. Tune in every week as we react to the latest in innovation and reflect on how short-term news impacts our long-term views. To learn more, visit ARK-invest.com.
ARK Investment Management, LLC is an SEC-registered investment advisor. ARK and Public are unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to either firm marketing or selling the products or services of the other, and therefore ARK disclaims responsibility for any loss that may be incurred by Public's clients or customers. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and/or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in the show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.
Welcome to The Brainstorm, episode 47. We're talking about AI again, and that is fitting because, you know, we like to talk about convergence. Brett, you've done a lot of work on the importance of AI, not just in and of itself, but how it powers all of our investment strategies. Could you just give a high-level takeaway there, and then we can dive into some of the big breakthroughs from this past week?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear over and over again, made clear that AI is accelerating and actually accelerating faster than even we've forecast. And what's interesting about that to us is not just the AI-specific investment plays that we have, but also because it accelerates and brings forward all of the other technologies that we focus on. And in some cases, actually, you know, in AI acceleration that then leads to Tesla being able to deliver a robotaxi, for example, is a much more meaningful financial impact on the company than some of the, you know, next generation internet plays. You know, lots of people have the big tech names in their portfolios and an AI acceleration there. In some ways, it could cut against kind of their core businesses. And so it's in some ways like a more mixed potential outcome for traditional tech exposures.
All right. And then I'm going to ask you to define these two phrases, and I think that'll take us into the conversation. What is a stochastic parrot and what is agentic AI? Those words, sure. I've heard those words thrown around a lot. So what are they?
Well, so you can think of stochastic as basically just random. A stochastic parrot is the idea that, you know, you begin a sentence and then a parrot kind of like randomly spits out the next words that it thinks is in the sentence. And that's a criticism of the AI language models is that, hey, these are not actually doing anything that is reasoned or reasonable. They just have like heard a lot of sentences. They've heard to be or not to be. And then they kind of know, well, that is the question is next, but they might even get it wrong. Like that is the query or something like that. And so it's just randomly filling in information and there's no kind of like underlying logic there. And agentic AI is the idea that I can set up an AI model and get it running. And rather than it just kind of infilling the next words in the sentence, it can actually task manage itself. It can say, oh, in order to fulfill this complex requirement that the user has asked, I need to figure out like what other tools I need to draw on, what APIs I need to look up and kind of code to. And so just like with an intern or even an employee, you can say, hey, can you, you know, get all of the data on used car sales across sedans for the past 15 years and construct a data set that shows me how prices have trended for four-door sedans? And it'll go out and figure out a way to do that. And so And the direction that these companies are going is to try to develop truly agentic systems, meaning instead of just something that is like a narrow tool, it's kind of like a broad set of knowledge workers you could spin up to do things on your behalf.
So Brett, can you maybe talk about some of the recent news, the Anthropic, and also maybe we get into the spring update with OpenAI as well?
Sure. So there's a researcher named Christian Lewis, who's a founder, and he demonstrated that AI models can, they can natively do logical reasoning kind of within the context of the model. And the way you think about it is they are Turing complete, meaning like you could run any program on the system. So why is this important? Well, one, like think of the difference between a calculator and a computer. Like a calculator can do a lot of stuff. It's very useful, but it's also very narrow and limited. A computer actually can do any really well-defined task a true computer can do anything that you sufficiently well define it. And an argument for the problem with AI models, these language models as currently constructed, that is provocative and potentially valid, has been that, well, because they're just stochastic parrots, because they just take to be or not to be, and then say, and that is the question, and then they keep trying to fill in the sentence, they get it wrong. And as they get it wrong, they get it more wrong. So their errors compound. And so if you have a way to make sure that they're adhering to logic, or if there were a way to make sure that they can error correct and be like, oh, actually this, you know, 1 + 1 actually equals 2, then potentially they could be provably agentic. They could provably do any task that you give to them. And so this researcher demonstrated that they can actually do that. They can kind of like adhere to logic and build and construct programs native to the AI system. And he specifically demonstrated on Anthropic's Claude model. There's reasons to believe it would work on GPT-4, but it really cuts against the idea that these systems are profoundly limited in some way and are just kind of like a thing that's a parlor trick that isn't going to lead to agentic work ultimately.
Before we keep going down this, I just want to try and tie it back to ARC's research and modeling, where, right, you can look at big ideas. Our forecast for market cap attributable to AI is lots of trillions. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head.
It's more than 90 trillion for AI software in business context by 2030.
Okay. And so, right, everyone thought stochastic parrot, now Turing complete. Is this something that changes the trajectory, or is this something that necessarily had to come along in order to achieve that goal? Is this just a change in timing? Like, yeah. When you hear this, right, it's like, wow, this is happening. We didn't even think this is possible. And yet we have more than 90 trillion attributable to AI software. How does this tie into existing research framework?
Well, I think so. The basis for that forecast is we think on average, accommodating the penetration rate, that AI software is going to improve the productivity of knowledge workers by 4 to 5 times. So every knowledge work employee, think a coder or a salesperson, will be 4 to 5 times more productive. And you could imagine if these AI models were chronically limited to just kind of infilling material, then they would be much more tied to kind of like the amount of time that knowledge worker could directly supervise them. As in, you know, I want to write up a piece for a newsletter, and I kind of like feed in loosely what I want to be written up, and then the AI model generates it, and then I read it. So it in some ways, it maybe would only lead to like some like percentage increase in my productivity rather than a multiples increase. If you have like a truly agentic system, then any individual worker can become more of like a supervisor of multiple processes that are running on AI at once. And so to me, it's suggestive, even on the existing set of models that are out there, that we could keep doing work to engineer and figure out how to use these things and deliver across many employees multiples of productivity. Now, our forecast anticipates that these models are going to continue to get better. And I think that there's you know, no evidence that's opposed to that. I think that the, you know, the next OpenAI model will be much better than this one. And, you know, there will be competitive models as well. And so, you know, in some ways, this is, it illustrates that even with the existing set of tools, there's the potential to deliver that kind of productivity, and that there is still so much room to understand and grow the capability of these systems.
I did try and have the most recent, and maybe we'll use this to talk about OpenAI's spring update. I went in and I was like, okay, I've just done a lot of work on humanoid robots, but let's see what it can do. So I was like, okay, give me a blog about humanoid robots. And I gave it my outline. And then I was like, okay, but run an NPV analysis and like make reasonable assumptions. And then it made a tornado chart showing sensitivity to each input. And I was like, okay, but you got to frame this, like what's the addressable market? And it pulled, you know, global hours worked, everything like that. So it's getting, it's not quite there.
So but what sounds like you have a blog.
What I'm saying is the next blog you read from me is going to be heavily GPT influenced.
Yeah.
So what it was the big OpenAI spring announcement?
Yeah, and so in some ways it's like the research on, hey, these things can be Turing complete, and kind of there's a huge agentic potential here, is actually cuts separately from what OpenAI announced, which is OpenAI took a model, its previous GPT-4 model was trained on text, and there was like some separate capability on image generation and separate capability on training on images. And now it's trained on text, audio, and image in a native, they call it like omnimodal way. And they clearly did a lot of work to also make it extraordinarily responsive. And so, and making it responsive means it generates output quicker, but a benefit alongside that is it also is cheaper to generate that output. And so basically they delivered a model that is meaningfully more performant than anything that's out there on benchmarks, and is half the cost to run. So at a very high level, go back to when GPT-4 was released in March of 2023. Since then, the models have become between 6 and 8x less costly to run and 6 and 8x faster to generate output. So if you cross those two and say, well, people really want, you know, quality performance at a certain speed, then on a cost per performance basis, the cost of the cutting edge leading model in the world has fallen roughly 60-fold over a little more than a year. And so then within their demo, when you have like much quicker responsiveness, and because it's trained on audio directly rather than audio that's then transferred into text and then trained on that, the model can also respond orally and interpret and inflect emotion into how it responds. So if you've seen the movie Her, like there's going to be a lot of people falling in love with voice AI systems over the course of, you know, really the next couple years, because this model is like, it's like having a conversation with someone. And so there's both like the high level, like quantitatively, this is how much this has improved. And then the actual subjective thing that they delivered, which is, oh, I can totally see how people are going to spend a lot of time learning from this, falling in love with this, using this for entertainment, and really having it serve as a creative and intellectual partner in all kinds of enterprises and exercises.
All right, Nick, can I ask you a question here?
Sure. Yeah.
So, well, one, it's right. We've got all of human intelligence 60x cheaper than previously before. And I see that Sweetgreen can't sell a $15 salad profitably. So do with that information what you will. But Nick, you have spoken about this, and I think it's the right thing to explore, which is OpenAI announcement, very impressive, ahead of what seems to be everyone else, but does it matter, right? And there's this rumor of them partnering with Apple or Apple partnering with them. And so the question I have for you is, should Apple be paying for OpenAI's model, or should OpenAI be paying to be the default on an Apple phone, hypothetically?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good question, and I'm going to end this tangent with another question for both of you. But I do think distribution is increasingly important in this space. Obviously, it's very clear OpenAI has a significant lead over competitors, but we should assume over time that lead, the gap, closes. And so once you get to, you know, equal performance or relative performance metrics on all of these different benchmarks we look at, are consumers going to care about slightly better performance from OpenAI versus Anthropic, Perplexity, however you want to, you know, splice and dice the space, versus ease of convenience and use, as in, you know, does distribution at the end of the day prove to be the largest moat and factor for these services? And in my opinion, and this again is just from the consumer side, I think distribution is underappreciated in this space. I mean, we've seen how performant OpenAI is, but I still believe that their users have tapped out at around, what is it, 100 to 200 million? You know, so they're not continuing that explosive trajectory that they saw in the beginning. And I guess my question is, and, you know, I watched the spring update. It is truly incredible. I think it's going to change a lot of how we interact with these models. But, and this is a question for both of you, if OpenAI and ChatGPT and Perplexity and all these different models are only ever applications on iOS or an application on a desktop, have they failed to live up to their potential? In my opinion, it's yes, right? If OpenAI is only ever an application on Apple's, you know, in the App Store, it's completely failed relative to what the potential is for AI. And Brett, I can see you're thinking because you had the icon pop up. But I'm going to leave it there because I want to get your takes. Because in my opinion, like, this needs to transfer to the OS. Like, this needs to be natively embedded into the OS. It has to have a tight integration with the hardware. And there are gatekeepers preventing that or will have significant influence in how that rolls out. But I'll end there.
Well, I think one of the comments from, was it Suhail? I don't know his name. I'm butchering his name. But
Suhail.
Suhail.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Go on. His point was desktop is actually smart because then you forget about the browser, right?
Yeah.
You've transcended the browser, mm-hmm. which is a powerful position. But then the question is on mobile, right? I think to your point, mobile, you need to be integrated into something, not just an app.
Right. Well, Brett, I mean, I think that's actually a savvy analogy, as in, if you think about the power of the browser, right? Like, the browser, it is like a quasi operating system that lives on top of kind of other OSs. And, you know, there's at least an opportunity to kind of like slot in there and think about how much of the kind of like economics of tech you can displace if you sit in the browser slot or as the alternative to the browser. There's like a huge pool of money you can suck out of there, you know, and it could be that the Apple OpenAI deal is actually not a money transfer at all. It's Apple desperately needs something that works because Siri is a joke. And OpenAI does need the distribution and says, hey, let's strike a deal where we become your default voice thing. And we'll just take the data, you know, and Apple is actually impaired to some degree. Like, if you read about Apple's corporate practices around data and their adherence to privacy, I mean, I guess it's laudable, but it is blinding their developers. Like, they don't even know what Siri is being used for. I mean, partly because it's not, but also because they can't, they have like a restrictions on being able to see how and if people use it. So it's so, like, from the end user perspective, it's clear it's so bad. They might not even know how bad it is, you know? And so if OpenAI strikes a deal where it's like, we help you with this kind of strategic weakness you have, and we're just going to take the user data, and then that gives the OpenAI the distribution to keep itself accelerating its advantage in kind of the performance of these models, then I think you know, potentially that allows OpenAI to continue to grow until it gets so big that it then absorbs and tries to kill Apple, like, you know, some kind of parasite digging into its brain. And I think, Nick, to your question, I think there is an open question of, it's like, how good an AI girlfriend does somebody really need? You know, but when, like, the other kind of use case here is, hey, AI, could you please negotiate with Verizon to get me a cheaper cell phone bill? And then, like, your ability to get a cheap cell phone bill will be a function of how powerful is your AI versus Verizon's corporate AI that's trying to protect itself. And so then it's like really a zero. It's like, if you have a better one, you net save money. And that's the kind of, like, economic game that then means people always want the best, because it's actually, yeah, you know, lines their pockets to have the best rather than costing them money.
Yeah.
And I'm just imagining, I think, like, a little Pokemon battle between my AI and Verizon's. It's like, tries, cancel subscription.
Yeah. And I think the point you made, Sam, around the browser versus the mobile ecosystem, the browser is like the wild, wild west compared to the mobile ecosystem, which is extremely privacy centric. It's locked down. You have to have all sorts of permissions to interact, you know, beyond just your own application. And that's where, you know, this question for me, I keep coming back to it. If it's only an application in the mobile ecosystem, how much can you really do? How agentic can that model be if the mobile ecosystem is preventing you from integrating and working with different applications? But the browser, different story, right? You'll be able to have that ability. I think it's just mobile is important to think about, because that's our primary computing device these days for the majority of the population.
And I think the outcome there is actually quite binary, or it could be, as in, you know, maybe this is finally the wedge that allows, like, that kind of, like, fragments kind of the mobile hardware software integration. Maybe this is the thing where it's kind of like, yeah, I'm okay with Apple because it just works, but it's no longer just working relative to what I can do with other things. And so therefore I transition out of, like, the constellation of devices and services that I'm stuck with Apple, because they've just stopped delivering me actually world-class performance. And I think you can make the counter argument that Apple's ecosystem is so strong and tightly woven that it's really hard to even displace marginal users out of it, particularly the high income users that are most valuable, into something else. And so then Apple continues to gatekeep it and in some ways, like, holds AI into, like, a narrow little sphere here. And the other, you know, people are referring to her a lot because of the OpenAI announcement, but, you know, her is also a cautionary tale of what happens when somebody else owns your AI girlfriend, right? Where you don't have control of it yourself. Like, think of how much economic leverage a company has over somebody if they've fallen in love with the AI system. Like, what would they pay to not have that AI girlfriend get deleted? And so there's really, like, I think, strong arguments for, actually, you really need to own your model locally at some point rather than, you know, rely on a corporate overlord to treat you nicely when you've fallen in love.
Yeah.
And then another point of discussion, free trial, right? Normally the cutting edge is not made available for free. OpenAI is making it available. There's limits. And there's different speculations about this. One is, do they need the data, right? It's like, have they hit a plateau in what they're seeing, and so they just need more people to do it? Is it distribution, to what Nick's saying? Right, even right now, it does feel like the X/Twitter bubble. Nick, I don't know if it's made it over to Threads, people talking about it, but it's like people are going crazy about this, and you talk to someone in the real world who isn't all over this and no idea what's going on. So why is this the move now?
Nick, you think it's advertising business model that's going to emerge, right?
I think it's advertising. And I think this is going back to your prior question, Sam. Does Apple pay for OpenAI's model, or does OpenAI
pay Apple to be Apple's model. And I think it might end up being the latter, as in, if you think about the deal that Google and Apple have, it's, you know, Google pays to be the default search engine behind Safari, and that's a $20 billion deal. I think this is going to shape up similarly in the early days, as in, I think there's probably some monetary compensation behind the scenes where, and there will be multiple layers of this. And so I think, getting back to your free trial standpoint, I think OpenAI is saying, we are delivering so much value, but the everyday consumer has no understanding of what we're able to do, as in, the utility continues to increase, but our distribution isn't reaching that, you know, average, you know, consumer. And so we need to get it this into the hands of as many people as possible. And that means we're going to have to pay for distribution or give it out for free. And that's, you know, essentially paying for it, because you have inferencing costs and all of your internal costs that are now not being covered by a subscription. So I think they're looking at this saying, we need to hit escape velocity. We need to have, you know, 500 to a billion users on this, because then we cement our place as the most important model. And that gives us an extremely large moat. It becomes something akin to a social network, in that you need to build a network effect, and everyone needs to be, I think, standardized onto a specific model, because there is something to be said about, oh yeah, I use it in this way, I use it in that way. And then, you know, word of mouth allows you to explore and use the model in different ways that you wouldn't have prior, you know, thought to. And I think it is, you know, a bit of a bubble, in the sense that you really only hear about it in these tech circles, because they're the ones, you know, they're early adopters in this. But if, you know, I talk to my mom or someone else that's not, you know, using this on an everyday basis for their job, they're not using it as a just normal consumer in most cases.
Yeah, I think that the reason Google pays for the distribution is because then they have a back end monetization engine that you know, more than pays for the cost of grabbing that traffic. And for, on the OpenAI side, you're absolutely right. Providing it free is basically like paying for distribution. It's also likely that they're going to launch a GPT-5, and GPT-5 will remain in the paid tier. And they'll always be in this stance where there's a direct paid that a subset of users are using, who are really using it for utility. Like, I'm doing work, like I'm really delivering some kind of like ROI on paying for it. And then a free tier, which is, performance, less latent, and can be used for more consumption type use cases. And I think that they will optimize to some kind of, it might not be advertising directly, but some kind of marketing model to support that. As in, if you have an AI girlfriend and she's telling you to buy some shoes, and actually she really likes Nikes, well, you're not going to disappoint her, are you? You know, and so I think there's a lot of, like, you know, talk about persuasive marketing. Like, there's a lot of room to like develop business models around kind of indirect monetization. And you're absolutely right. Above a certain threshold number of users, it actually really makes you difficult to displace, because you get into this data intake. There's actually good scale economics to inference. One of the ways that I think they were able to deliver lower cost inference, so a halving in the cost, is because they actually fragment the model into more experts, they're called, and you actually need to have a very high volume of queries in order to successfully balance all of those experts. And so there's a virtuous cycle, and kind of like the inbound query volume you get and your ability to deliver faster and less expensive answers. And so they may be looking, and it's like, if we can get, you know, across all of Apple, we can actually reduce our inference costs again and increase performance again. And then we can figure out the constructed, you know, marketing business model on the back end.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that another potential business model here is storage for context? As in, like, I'm very happy paying $2 to $3 for my iCloud storage. Why wouldn't you also bundle that into, you know, here's the amount of storage we're giving to the context of all of the conversations you've had with this AI? Because then there is performance gains, right? Like, the more I'm willing to pay to store the context I've had with this model, the better and more personalized this model will be over time. And I feel like you could probably build a pretty solid business model off of, demonstrating how, you know, storing context leads to better performance and personalization over time, instead of just giving away that for free.
That's a great idea.
50 first dates dilemma. It's like, this is your AI girlfriend, but she only has a 1 day context window.
right. But then it's like every day you have to start over and you have to retrain this to understand it, instead of like, I think if it was framed in that manner, I think that would resonate with me as a consumer, because I'm already teed up to understand that, right? Like, I pay for cloud storage through my phone and my laptop, and all of that is consolidated. It's easy for me to go back and look through photos and videos. I think there might be something to that.
So that's a great point. Because one of the, and it was buried beneath the like glitz of their demo, but they also talked about being able to have memory across different conversations you've had with the AI. And, you say like, well, what's the difference in performance this one to this one? Actually, you don't really care about having the smarter AI system more than you do the AI system that knows like, oh, on Thursdays you have to do this thing, or, you know, it has actually your local like calendar context, you know, you like chocolates rather than ice cream or whatever it is, you know? And so I think that's And it also, you know, distribution not only gets you the data, but then you're beginning to accrue the histories with these people that they won't want to erase and start over from.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Maybe to round this, Nick, I have a closing question, but
close it out then, Sam.
Okay. The Gartner hype cycle, tech trigger, peak of inflated expectations, trough disillusionment, slope of enlightenment, then plateau. Happens in almost every cycle. This isn't representative of the adoption curve, right? You can look at the adoption curve of most technologies and it's just the classic S curve up and to the right. But beneath that, you've got expectations and leverage built in to seemingly every cycle. So far, I've only heard higher and higher expectations of AI capability. Where on this cycle do you think we are? And do you think it transcends the cycle? Brett, Nick, you go first.
I'll offer maybe a unique opinion here. I think performance continues at the model level to increase, and we don't see a slowdown on a performance basis for many years. And that's really what we've heard from companies, Meta, OpenAI, you know, we're continuing to see performance gains. However, the utility of the underlying models to the end consumer plateaus. And it's because of the points I brought up around gatekeeping within the mobile app ecosystem. Maybe the browser begins to show that performance, but the way that I would frame it is, we're going to get to agentic AI before consumers have the ability to use it in that way. So the capability to be agentic will be there. The use of it won't be there because of gatekeeping around these, you know, large ecosystems. You won't be able to actually do what these models are capable of until you see kind of a lowering of the guard and privacy and all of that, where this will need to open up before you can actually use the models the way that they've been built.
Yeah, I think that that hype cycle is interrelated to both the end consumer expectations, including in this case at the enterprise level and the consumer level, and also the capital markets and kind of like capital market kind of call it froth. And the macroeconomic environment is set up in such a way that I don't think that we're not in the capital markets froth stage yet. You could argue that NVIDIA is evidence that we are. But it hasn't moved downstream into the application space. You haven't seen companies coming to market with IPOs. You haven't seen kind of like I haven't had random people reach out to me to be like, what AI name do I need to invest in? Which is usually my own internal sign of like, okay, this is like getting over its skis, where you have like the average consumer not just using and being excited by the product, but then actively seeking to get financial leverage against the capability of the product. And there is always the reason the hype cycle is a sticky concept is because it always happens. Like, there's there's going to be a stage in which it really is kind of like in total explosion mode, where there's financial leverage built in, where companies are promising things that aren't actually going to be achieved and making like bets that are going to fail spectacularly. I just don't think we're there yet within the AI context. And I think that, you know, it's likely over the course of this cycle, it almost certainly will happen. And it's also, even if, as you say, the utility of the models continues to develop, people will get ahead of the curve some, and then they'll be like, oh, I can, you know, get leverage on that. And you can see that in like little micro moments. Like, I think a lot of, you know, the AI large language model companies, there's been a minor shakeout here with some that are falling off the pace. And I think you'll see it across different parts of the stack. But right now it's particularly, you know, within the capital markets, I think it's clearly evident that people actually are pretty skeptical of this. Like, look at how Tesla is underwritten. It really is underwritten as if robotaxi is not something that's possible, I think, you know.
Well, so then, Brett, an interesting one area where I think you can argue whether it's froth or not, but it's certainly following the tech moment, capital inflow, company creation, which is humanoid robots, right? And so it's like, there's certainly a lot of company creation around humanoid robots, which is inherently tied to, I'd say, developments in AI. I feel like this is a fairly niche company space, but it seems almost certain that all of the humanoid robot companies being created right now are not going to make it to the other side. So the, sure. You know, there's one spot of not fraud, but company creation.
Like, if you think about like venture funding is between 200 and 400 billion. It's like 450 billion per year, 200 in a good year, and 200 something in a bad year, right? That mm-hmm. being like, you know, last year and the year before ish. Right. So how much money has actually gone into funding the humanoid, not the market cap, not the value creation, but how much money is actually plugged into that space? It's, you know,
fairly low
relative to that. And then think about like, you know, the venture market versus the entire public equity markets, which are, you know, 100 trillion plus. And so, you know, venture is maybe 10% of that in terms of total value. And so kind of like you have, you know, there are stages to these things, and you can have like micro bubbles along the way. But when it gets into public equities, that's when you bring, you know, everybody on board and people start, you know, I think it creates the real kind of financial leverage event that there's no further market to sell into. And so then you get kind of like the full peak and then the drawback.
All right. I don't want to toot our own horns here, but I thought this was a fairly good episode. Interesting conversation. The listeners, let us know. Comment if you thought this is actually terrible, how to improve it. Constructive feedback, always welcome.
All right. Thank you, everyone.